In this episode, Chad Graham gives a talk on the historical foundations for church and state relations. Afterwards, we have a roundtable discussion on the topic. I hope you enjoy the talk and the conversation.
Well, many are curious today about how the church and the state should relate to one another. This is particularly true in the age of COVID restrictions, but a number of other things that are occurring in culture. Depending on what side of the spectrum, of course, that the observer is on, they'll either see the relationship of the church and state as too permissive and too cozy, or as too restrictive and too hostile. And every observer of whatever stripe will realize that today there is a change occurring between the relationship of the church and the state in the West, generally. Now, I've been given the task first of considering what the sort of historic Christian position is in relationship to the church and the state, and then how then the church ought to relate, how Christians ought to relate to their government. Looking at the first part, what the relationship between church and state should be sets the foundation for how we ought to respond. And I think every fan of Sid Meier's Civilization will recognize with fondness the voice of Star Trek's Leonard Nimoy, marking one of the player's most significant changes and developments. When a pop-up comes up and you hear him say, "There are two cities formed by two loves. The first, the city of God. The second, the city of man." This comes from St. Augustine's City of God and shows us that their relationship between church and state should be a relationship between two neighboring or distinct political systems. Robert Barr argues that in this work, Augustine left to Western culture one of its most influential pieces of literature, philosophy, and theology, and it was a timely piece. The early 5th century, you see, had just seen the old political certainties collapse. In AD 410, the Visigoths had sacked the Vandals had sacked Rome, and things were not looking good. Refugees had fled from Italy into Africa, and they had come to the Christian leader of Hippo, the city in which Roman generals were making their last stand to protect civilization. And there they asked Augustine, "How could this thing be? Is this not a Christian empire? Why is God not on our side?" And Augustine's reaction was a very radical explanation. I'll give you a few more segments of the quote here. "These are the two loves. The first is holy, the second is foul. The first is social, the second is selfish. The first consults the common welfare for the sake of a celestial society. The second grasps at a selfish control of social affairs for the sake of arrogant domination. The first is submissive to God, the second tries to rival God." In the end of the day, one is just and the other is unjust. And in the ancient world, to speak of two cities, to speak of cities in this way, was to speak of the political order. All politics were based around cities. You were either a citizen of the city of Athens or ultimately a citizen of the city of Rome. In fact, our word civics comes from the Latin word for city, civitas. What Augustine is trying to do in the City of God is to show us that all political systems in this world are transitory, temporal. The Roman people had thought of Rome as the eternal city, and they couldn't conceive of how the world could go forward without Rome. Where else would hope be found? Where would peace and stability be found? And Augustine says, no, it's not found in the temporal politics of the city of man. It is found in the permanent politics of the city of God. The Christian is not only a citizen of the nation they live in this world. All nations in this world are subparts of the city of man. But the city of God is coming and moving away the politics of the city of man. And as it is doing so, Christians are brought into the new political reality. And as they live in the cities of this world, which are still dominated by the city of man, Christians have a role and a duty. Their duty is to live out the values and realities of the city of God, to demonstrate to all people what their founder taught. To paraphrase Christianity's founder, Jesus Christ, Christian society was to be in the world, but not of the world. The Gospel of John, for example, records Jesus' description of his followers. "They are not of the world," he said, "just as I am not of the world." So the relationship between the church and the state can first be comparable to the relationship between two civic orders, two political neighbors. But those neighbors are placed together in a relationship and in such a way that the relationship becomes a relationship of an embassy in a foreign land. 3 centuries before Augustine wrote, another Roman citizen, learned in the ways of Rome, had adopted Christianity. And at that time, Christianity was not in the position it had been in Augustine's time. It was not a Christian empire, but an anti-Christian empire, an empire that was fairly hostile to Christianity. And the man that would become known as St. Paul wrote to Roman Christians living in a Roman colony, Philippi, in the midst of recently conquered Greek territory. The settlers there were surrounded by an ancient dominant Greek culture, and they were called upon by Rome to live in such a way that their behavior and habits and functions would show the Greeks that it was to their benefit to basically become Roman. This became a word picture for St. Paul to write to the Christians of the city, that our citizenship is in heaven. As such, he instructed the Philippians, behave as citizens worthy of the gospel, just as Rome called them to do in the Greek territories. In another letter to the community of Christians at Corinth, a prominent Greek city, Paul explained, look, we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. So an image of a Roman colony in this territory, or the image of an embassy, are both apropos for the early Christian community. They saw themselves as representatives of the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, or as Paul would call him, the Lord of Glory. And so the relationship of church and state is a relationship of two political societies. And in this world, the relationship is that of an embassy from the city of God to the cities that are dominated by the city of man. Sometimes these embassies will be formally recognized and honored and have a place of respect in community. And other times, they won't formally be embassies at all. They'll be missions. Missions that are suspected and looked at negatively by the society and in hostile, potentially very hostile, territory. So not only are there two systems, and not only is it to be seen as an embassy, but it also might be that the relationship is that of migrants in a strange land. One late 1st or into early 2nd century writer, known as an apologist, made a case for the toleration of Christians in the Greco-Roman Empire. The writer described the aliens, the strangers, the migrants, or pilgrims who lived amongst the Greeks as strangers in a strange land. Here's just a few words from what he wrote. Christians are neither by country or language or custom distinguished from the rest of humanity. For they do not dwell somewhere in their own cities, nor do they use some strange language, nor do they practice a particular way of life. But he writes, while living in both Greek and barbarian cities, as each have obtained by lot, and while following the local customs both in clothing and in diet and the rest of the life, they demonstrate the wonderful and most certainly strange character of their own citizenship. They live in their own countries, but as aliens. They marry like everyone else, they bear children and so on, they set a common table. They happen to be in the flesh, but they do not live in the flesh. They spend time upon the earth, but they have citizenship in heaven. They obey all of the appointed laws, and in their own lives they actually surpass the laws of the land. They love all people, but by all people are persecuted. They are unknown, and they are condemned. They are put to death, but made alive. They are poor, but make many rich. They lack everything, and they have abundance in everything. They are dishonored, and in dishonored, glorified. They are slandered, but they are vindicated. They are reviled, but they give blessing. They are insulted, but they give honor. And in when doing good, they are punished as evildoers. When punished, they rejoice as having received life. To put it simply, what the soul is in the body is what the Christians are in the world. This seems to be a reflection of what Jesus' leading disciple, Peter, wrote when he wrote to the elect exiles scattered throughout the empire. I urge you, he said, as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh which war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that though they speak of you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether the emperor supreme or the governor sent by him. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of your opponents. Live as people who are free, he concludes. but not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil. But as servants of God, honor everyone. In sum, the church and the state are two separate but related civilizations. Sometimes the relationship is one of respected embassy, and other times, a suspect mission. Second, the church should relate to the state in practical ways. Having understood the historic Christian understanding of the relationship between church and state, the church ought to relate to the state in practical ways that reflect this. There are three practical applications that I see coming out of this historic Christian view of the relationship between church and state. First, Christians should not hitch themselves to any particular political party or solutions. Second, Christians should determine what sort of relationship their embassy has with the current state or government they dwell with, and then respond accordingly. Third, Christians should use whatever legal means they have in order to maintain the dignity and rights of an embassy of the kingdom of heaven. So to go to that first point, Christians shouldn't hitch themselves to a particular political party or agenda. Christianity is political, but it should be politically apolitical. There's no doubt that everything about Christianity has a political impact. But our politics, Christianity's politics, are simply not of this world. Confusion around Christian interaction and secular government is simply nothing new. In fact, the first century Roman government didn't know what to do with Christianity's founder. Remember when Pilate had Christ before him, he asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews? Are you a political adversary to Rome?" And Jesus replied to him that the truth was much more complicated, that his kingdom was a spiritual kingdom, not of this world. Pilate, in frustration, said, "Ah, what is truth?" and then put Jesus to death. Not an auspicious start to the interaction between church and state, but that was the start. The city of man simply doesn't understand the city of God. One major mistake Christians have made so many times throughout the centuries is thinking that a political movement is going to be their great hope. It doesn't matter what side of the spectrum it's on. For example, Martin Lloyd-Jones laments at the beginning of the 20th century that many Welsh churchmen had hitched themselves to the Labour Party, a left-wing party in Great Britain, hoping that they would bring about a utopia. It didn't work. They were disappointed. Many early 21st century Christians, more to the right side of the spectrum, in the United States, for example, may have hitched themselves to the mega movement under recent President Donald Trump. Now, being politically active is not the issue. It's certainly fine for Christians to be engaged in politics. In fact, they ought to. But, as Augustine pointed out, all of these systems, all of these politics are temporary. Temporary. The temporary systems of the city of man will never provide ultimate hope and help. That is left for the city of God. We cannot elect a pastor-in-chief and place our hope in a Christian nation. That's what was going on in the 5th century, and Augustine had to speak to the Christians about it. We need to think more radically. We need to look to our own resources. And today, as the church thinks about how to respond to the government, we need to start with ourselves. What can we do to take care of ourselves and to conduct our mission apart from and not relying on our government? That's our first step. Rod Dreher has written an interesting book called The Benedict Option, where he says this is going to become more and more necessary for Christians. That's a valuable resource to look up. So first, Christians should be politically apolitical. Secondly, Christians should understand the political times. There's an Old Testament Hebrew scripture which speaks of the men of Issachar as men who had understanding of the times, who knew what Israel ought to do. Christianity in the West has often enjoyed the benefit of being in a respected embassy. The state might not have always understood the church, but it often gave it a great deal of respect. However, during the 16th to 18th centuries, Reformation Christianity often experienced outright hostility from the state and became a suspected or hated mission. The first 3 centuries of the church, the same thing. They were a suspected and hated mission. Immediately after the fall of Rome, there were areas where the church was a suspected and hated mission. This is not something new. It goes in cycles. The church today in North America, however, continues to enjoy the immense privileges of embassy. And these freedoms should be used as opportunities to serve God. But there are certain times and places where the church will find itself more of a mission, and we need to judge that correctly before we speak out. Jesus said to be wise as serpents, but innocent as doves. I'm afraid sometimes we're dumb as dodos and guilty as foxes. The church should respond differently depending on what the culture around it is like. It's not a change of message, but it's a change of approach. Finally, Christians should use the legal resources available to them. While Christians, whenever it depends on them, should be at peace with all and aspire to live quiet lives minding their own businesses, you cannot simply allow the kingdom of heaven to be assaulted and insulted. Ambassadors in every political mission, even those in a relatively hostile culture, can and often must assert their rights for the glory of the home nation. In this, Jesus is himself again the example. When being judged before Pontius Pilate, he wasn't rude and obnoxious, but he did not acknowledge Pilate as supreme. He noted, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it was given to you from above." St. Paul, as a Roman citizen, also is an example. He made many appeals for the protection of Roman law over and over again. After being mistreated in Philippi in Acts chapter 17, he declared, "We are Roman citizens." And this led the magistrates to apologize to him. Before the court of Felix in Alexandria in Acts 24, he followed the rules of the court, saying, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense." He trusted the courts. Finally, in Acts 25, when it looked like he was not getting a just hearing, he made an appeal from the lower court to a higher court. "I appeal to Caesar." And he told the Philippians he expected to find justice at this highest court. So Paul used the rights that he had as a Roman citizen. He trusted the courts, and he appealed when he didn't get a just response. Many apologists in the early church took up Paul's example and approach. One of my personal favorites, is Athenagoras of Athens. He wrote to the emperor Marcus Aurelius in very winsome and polite terms, and he appealed this way. "In your empire, greatest of sovereigns, different nations have different customs and laws, and no one is hindered by law or fear of punishment from following his ancestral usages, however ridiculous these may be. Individuals live in and the possession of equal rights. But for us who are called Christians, you have not in a like manner cared. But although we commit no wrong, nay, as it will appear in the sequel of this discourse, are of all men most piously and righteously disposed towards the deity and towards your government. You allow us to be harassed, plundered, and persecuted, the multitude making war upon us for our name alone. We venture, therefore, to lay a statement of our case before you." It's a civil rights case, an appeal for a minority to be protected from the majority. From these three principles, then, that Christianity is politically apolitical, that Christians should read the political society in which they are in correctly and respond differently, and Christians should use whatever legal means they have, I come to this conclusion. Christians should do everything in their power to appear winsome and good. That means in this day, going out of our way to follow regulations and expectations of the state, even when we don't like them. Christians should do everything in our power to witness to the gospel, even if sometimes that means having to violate unjust regulations and expectations of the state and society in which they live in. But they should do everything they can to win over the laws of that state for their protection and appeal to those laws for the sake of the gospel. One key way we can do that today is by speaking to our governments. Those that have great concerns about regulations and shutdowns and lockdowns right now should reach out to their local chief ministers of health, their local member of parliament federally, provincially their local MLA or MPP or MNA, depending on what province you're living in, the local city and municipal authorities. Most of these people are very responsive to polite writing, much like Athenagoras of Athens did when he wrote out, "You're very just. Justice is done in this land, and we are making an appeal to have equal treatment, the same kind of treatment as everybody else." I think if we understand the historic Christian position, that the church and the state are two different neighboring political systems, and that the church lives in the world as citizens of the kingdom of heaven amongst nations that are under the citizenship, the reputation of the city of man, the church should see itself as a mission or as an embassy that is there to win people over to heaven's way of life. And so doing, and reading that correctly, we can live in this world as politically apolitical in our local systems, as reading the way the direction is going correctly, and as winning over the laws in claiming our rights as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven. And in this way, the church will have opportunities for the gospel and honor God and protect those who are most vulnerable among us. Thank you.
So we're here to talk about the historical foundations for church and state relations. Now, Chad, you gave a little bit of a talk on this, and I'm curious if you could maybe give a little bit of a summary of the city of God and the city of man. And from there, we'll have a discussion about it, because it's a fascinating topic deep in Christian history and in political thought. So go ahead.
Yeah. So Augustine, the author, is one of the greatest thinkers in the ancient world. And basically the circumstances they were in was a massive collapse of civilization and everything that everyone had understood. There was a barbarian invasion into Rome, and refugees had fled to Italy. And where the Roman generals were making the last stand for civilization, the people came to the spiritual leader and said, "Tell us, how can this be? If we're a Christian nation, how can this be?" And Augustine had to address that. So he basically just tells people that they're confused when they tie their sense of Christian community into the temporary political nations of this world and not into the eternal kingdom of God. That's the fundamental thing. And then he says there are two cities born of two loves, one the love of God, one the love of man, one the love of selfishness, one the love of justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so he tells us to focus on the eternal, permanent, divine kingdom rather than the temporary, transient, fading kingdom.
So then, okay, let me think about this kind of abstract. So we have these two kingdoms characterized by two sorts of love. But we're all Christians, right? So, or maybe we're not all, but we in particular are. So what does that mean for us to be living in the city of man right now? Like, how can we love our neighbor and yet be characterized by not necessarily the love of man, right? What does that look like?
Well, yeah, and I think that gets into Jesus' words that we're to be in the world, but not of the world. And I categorize it as being politically apolitical. Christianity is vitally political, has a huge impact, and we impact to love our neighbor and we impact society, but we don't put our confidence in particular politics. I think like the beginning of the 20th century, when Martin Lloyd-Jones complained that Welsh Christians put their hope in the Labour Party to bring about a utopia. And we can think about the early part of the 21st century when the other side of the spectrum, Christians put their hope perhaps in the Donald Trump presidency in the United States or something to sort of restore and help Christian fortunes. And in either case, people could get tied up into relying on the government for their salvation and hope rather than resting in the kingdom of God.
What is fascinating that we live kind of in these two overlapping worlds, and we're struck by these different realities. It reminded me of Martin Lloyd-Jones, because he also talks about Christians in a certain way being too wrapped up into sort of political change. But his point isn't that political change is bad, nor right. that pursuing justice is bad. But what his point is that by means of preaching the gospel, focusing on that main thing, society does in fact change as an effect of it. So it's kind of this gospel-centered approach. And yet both of you are lawyers. Both of you are those who are alive and working in the civic realm of our Canadian society. So like, okay, let's say you are a Christian. Chris, for example, like, why are you in the civic realm? Why are you serving as a lawyer? How do you find value in this kind of city that you live in?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, for me, it comes down to, I think that's the gifting that God has given me. And I became convinced, you know, when I was in university, that that was a way that I could serve God and serve the church was in that realm. And so I've always very much walked into it with this mindset of, I'm not just a lawyer who happens to be a Christian. I'm a Christian lawyer. And as that has gone on, I've tried to also aspire to become a Christian legal scholar as well. But it is, you are wearing different hats. And so in one sense, when I write a paper, for example, on the Charter of Rights or freedom of religion, sometimes I get to reference theological concepts, but more often than not, I don't. And the arguments that I'm making are not biblical arguments. They're arguments based on the law. And yet at the same time, I have benefited greatly from thinking through what theologians throughout the history of the church have said about these issues to inform my own foundation before I go and I come up with a legal theory. So there's it's not a hidden agenda by any means, because I'm quite open about what I stand for and what I believe, but there is a translation that goes on. And I think that's maybe where it gets interesting, trying to be, as Chad, as you put it, politically apolitical, to try to bring these ideas, which are rooted in historic Christian doctrine and rooted in scripture, and say, okay, where does that line up with our law? How can I make an argument that's consistent with those things.
That's interesting. You're reminding me that there is a long Christian tradition of law and theology. So there's in the Justinian Law Code, and also I think the Law Code of Theodosius I was used actually in Reformation history in an interesting way. So in Zurich,
well, it's interesting. Go ahead.
No. I want to hear what you have to say. Then I'll tell you the anecdote.
Yeah, it's funny because often in law schools they will debate and discuss what field is most similar to law. And often you'll hear literary theory, sociology, all of these things. And I'm always kind of thinking it's theology because really when you boil it down to it, what are you doing? You are thinking in a systematic way. You're taking doctrines and you're trying to relate them to one another and figure out how to apply them consistently and purposively. And you're undertaking this kind of textual interpretation and you're trying to think, okay, what was the historical context in which this was written? What does the text itself actually just say on its face? And how do I apply that to this unique situation? So I think there's a lot of overlap there. And it's a shame that we don't see more of a study in Canadian public law schools about the ways in which law is similar to theology. Because even if students aren't going to buy into the theology part, I think there's a lot they could learn just by thinking about those themes.
Yeah. Well, even in the nature of hermeneutics, I mean, you have to approach legal historical texts with a particular way within it.
Luther went to law school, and I think you see in a lot of his discussions a mind that was attuned to the best legal hermeneutics of the day. Calvin was a constitutional law scholar and actually wrote work on clemency. I was trying to say holiday, sorry, too many ons. A work on clemency.
Positive examples. Yeah, not my
he's a true scholar of the law, and I think you also see again that comes out in the Reformation. But
so I want to
be shame.
Go on, sorry.
I'll give a shameless plug here, and I think in the church in Canada, what we need is, you know, it's interesting. I sometimes feel like I occupy these two worlds, right? And Chad, you probably feel that way sometimes too, where I've got my legal community and my Christian community, and then also I kind of got my Christian legal community in the middle. But one thing that I hope we can get to do more of, and I think if anything, the pandemic has highlighted the need for this, is to get Christian legal scholars to start conversing more with other Christian scholars in other fields. And, you know, I am working on a project to that effect, and hopefully that will be announced sometime in the next few months.
Great. Well, let me finish then asking one question. We've kind of already hinted at it, but when you talk about these two cities, you're not saying that if you're a Christian in this world, you should totally ignore this world. Both of you are legal professionals. There's good reason to put time and effort on making things better. So what does it really look like to be a migrant Christian in this world? Yeah. Granted, we know there's a particular mission for the church. I'd talk about that in my talk a little bit about these two kingdoms. But there's also just a regular civic good that we should pursue. There's justice and goodness. So let's talk about that for a little bit. What does it look like? Chad, maybe give some insight into that question.
So I actually framed it historically in two separate perspectives. One is an ambassadorial perspective that we see Paul bring out. And I think the illustration that he uses for the Philippian Christians makes sense of that. Philippi was a Roman colony city in a Greek territory. And its whole point was to win the Greeks over by showing how great it was to be Roman and to be this Roman institution in the midst there. So when he tells the Philippians, our citizenship is in heaven and live worthy as citizens of the gospel, he's telling them something they would implicitly understand. Just like we're Romans in a Greek territory, we're Christians in the city of man. And so sometimes there's an opportunity to speak with great confidence from an ambassadorial standpoint, God making his appeal through us. But the other times, there's also what we see, for example, Peter talking about that we're strangers and sojourners in a strange land. And I talked about the second century apologists, and particularly Athenagoras of Athens, who has to appeal to Marcus Aurelius to stop persecution of Christians. And he makes an appeal there. So on one side is sort of saying, hey, we're confident, we're partners in society with you, and we think what we're doing is going to make this world a better place. Just like Philippi thought it was improving Greece, the Christian church is improving Canada. So we can speak in ways that speak to the improvement of our state. Other times we're going to be that minority. And in those cases, I think then we got to say, hey, don't persecute us because we're actually good people. And that's what Athenagoras shows us. We're, you know, we don't dress differently than other people. We don't eat differently than other people, but but we love, we care for our neighbors, we're good citizens, and we shouldn't be persecuted.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of this anonymous letter to Diognetus in the second century. And
that's what I was actually quoting accidentally there.
Yeah, oh, you were? Okay. Yeah. The analogy, though, is that Christians are the soul to the body. The soul activates the body. So Christians, the church, activates the world. It gives life to the world. And we preserve goodness. We are the salt of the earth. And there's a real sense in which that's true. Well, thanks, guys. I think this is a good kind of introductory conversation to this topic. We're going to have more conversations. So let's close down there. So thanks for this chat, guys.